All right. Thank you so much. So today I'll be talking about work that appeared on the archive last night, actually. And that was work in collaboration with a student, Anna Maria Taki, and Neil Weiner, both at NYU. And the topic of our project was how you could use astrometry, which is the discipline that measures the positions and proper motions of stars and other luminous sources in the sky, to do halometry, which is a word we invented for the discipline that does the same for dark objects in the Milky Way halo. So we want to measure the position and proper motion of completely dark structures in the galactic halo. The key word in the title is not the one we invented, but the word from, which is what my talk is about. So we'll be using gravitational lensing of the weak and astrometric kind that's time variable. And so I'll try to argue today that this effect constitutes a sensitive probe for new physics beyond the standard model, in particular, specifically dark matter. So I realize the session is diverse dark matter models. To leading order, I don't care what the dark matter model is because I'll only be using the gravitational coupling. But if this program is successful, we might learn some things about what the dark matter model actually is. Okay, so I'm not going to show you a pie chart. I'm also not going to show you a picture of Vera Rubin or Fritz Zwicky, who figured out that velocities in gravitationally bound systems are too high than you could account for with visible matter. Because in fact, there was a much earlier instance where we figured out the presence of an apparently invisible massive body from its gravitational influence. So Le Verrier in 1846 studied Uranus's orbit and found that it was anomalous and that it could be explained by a massive object that was then 3 weeks later seen in the position that he predicted to within a degree. I'll get back to planets at the end of the talk, but most of it will be about the traditional dark matter. Okay, so another big chunk of the evidence for dark matter comes from structure formation, so how small density fluctuations in dark matter collapsed and formed the seeds of large-scale structures in the universe. So specifically, we know that in the early universe, the early universe was very homogeneous, with density fluctuations of a few parts in 10 to the 5 that later grew and collapsed to form what we see today. So this is the universe from our vantage point. You see it's no longer linear, so there's highly nonlinear fluctuations. So the galactic disk here, the galactic center here, that's Andromeda, and here you see the small and large Magellanic clouds and other satellites in the Milky Way. So that's what it looks like today, but that's not the full part of the story, because there are structures on scale smaller than the Milky Way satellites. At least we think that's the case. So there's a bunch of stuff that you don't see. So these are small subhalos in the Milky Way that are predicted to be there, but they're too small to have had significant star formation. So we don't see them directly. And so what I'll be arguing today is that perhaps you can use astrometric lensing. So the lensing of the background stars behind any one of these objects to detect their presence and maybe measure their location and motion. In particular, if a halo is in front of a dense star field, such as a large Magellanic cloud or the galactic disk, you have a high density of sources, angular number density of sources that you can do statistics on. Okay, so let me tell you about the basic physical effect. So I'll be talking about gravitational lensing of the astrometric and weak kind. Astrometric means I'm looking at the light deflection, the angular deflection, not the light magnification. And I'll be talking about the weak kind, which is just the fact that it's small. So I'm not looking at multiple images or anything like that. Okay, so this is the basic situation. You have a source I, like a star or an extragalactic source. And this is us, or the satellite that's observing the star. And if there's a lens L in between us and the source, the light path is deflected by the famous angle 4 times Newton's constant times the enclosed mass inside the impact parameter of the light divided by the impact parameter. So this is the distortion in the position on the sky. So the dashed line would be the light path without lensing. The solid line is the path with lensing, and so that's of the same order. And if you plug in numbers, so for a subhalo of 1 million solar masses, which is roughly the smallest structures we've seen in the universe, are only a little bit larger than this. And a huge impact parameter, 10 kiloparsec, which is roughly, you know, the distance to the galactic center. Even for such a huge impact parameter, the deflection that you see is on the order of a few microarc seconds, which is approximately the precision to which we can measure the positions of the stars today, using optical surveys and radio astrometry as well. So why have we not seen this? In particular, this impact parameter can be a lot smaller and thus the signal bigger. The reason is that this dashed line is unknown a priori. We didn't know the initial location of the star to begin with. So this picture here is actually distorted at a detectable level, but we don't see the distortion because the leading order it's static. So it could be that, yeah, so we do see probably a distorted picture of the background stars. But to leading order, we can see this distortion, so there'll be suppression from that. And secondly, you cannot go to small impact parameters without also suppressing this enclosed mass, because subhalos have a finite size. So actually the lensing angle goes to zero as the impact parameter gets smaller. For most finite size lenses. So there's two things you can do about these two facts. The first thing is that you can observe that the impact parameter is not constant, because in general, the lens moves, the source moves, and the observer moves. So you can look at time domain effects. So the time derivatives of this deflection. And secondly, yeah, while it is true that the finite size suppresses the effect, finite size also means that there are potentially many sources behind any one lens, so you can use correlations or statistics to measure tiny effects. Okay, so I'll be leveraging both of these things. Stop me for questions if you like, or remember them until the discussion.
What about finite size of source?
Finite, yeah, so I'll be talking about point sources like stars. Eventually, I'll talk about quasars as well, which do have a finite size. Maybe at the end or in the discussion. So I said we'll be leveraging time domain effects and statistics. So to give you an estimate of the numerical estimate of the size of these time domain effects. Basically, the angular velocity correction is the same as what I had on the previous slide, times a factor of v over b, where v is the rate of change of the impact parameter, and b is the impact parameter. And again, for similar numbers, so if the mass is 1 million solar masses and the impact parameter is 100 parsecs, you get an angular velocity that's 10 to the minus 3 microarc seconds per year. Likewise, for acceleration, if it's a solar mass and 10 to the minus 2 parsec, you get something on the order of 10 to the minus 3 microarc seconds per square year. Perhaps you're not familiar with these units, but I said the current resolution of astrometric surveys is measured in microarc seconds, and likewise, velocities and accelerations, if the mission lasts on the order of a year or a few years, will be on the order of microarc seconds per year, or microarc seconds per square year. So notice that these effects are a little bit too small to detect in any one star. But there are statistics. So the number of lens sources behind any one object can be large. So sigma naught is the angular number density of stars. And current survey, a survey like the upcoming, or the current Gaia survey, will see 10 to the 9 stars over a full 4 pi solid angle. So you get an angular number density of 10 to the 8 per steradian. And if your source has a size of 100 parsec and is 10 kiloparsec away, then it has a solid angle of 10 to the minus 4. So you have 10 to the 4 stars behind such an object. So you can do Rudin statistics on those 10 to the 4 stars. And for small objects, you can make use of the fact sometimes that for many lenses and many sources, the minimum impact parameter can be quite small. So if you have a population of lenses that makes up 1% of dark matter, and that is solar mass in mass, and you have 10, and if you look at 10 to the 9 stars, the smallest impact parameter is on the order of 10 to the minus 5 parsecs. So you can look for correlations in this large population of lens sources, and there's occasional rare events where you have a close angular approach between a source and a lens. So these time domain effects have been explored before. Our main innovation is that we invented close to optimal signal observables that leverage these high statistics. Okay, so these are five different signal observables. The simplest one is to look for outliers. So here's a field of 4 stars. What if there's a point-like lens here that has a close approach with this star? If everything was stationary but the lens, if the lens is moving up, the angular deflection of the star would not be constant, and you would get a fictitious apparent acceleration of the star. And that could be so high as to not be caused by a binary companion or some other gravitational attraction. Probably the most famous one, and the one that had been considered before, is what we call a monoblip observable. So if you imagine a point mass lens moving up, so initially, so the deflection is always away from the lens. So the initial position of the star is here, and as the lens traverses these five positions, the star does this little wiggle that we call a blip, while stars farther away are not affected. So this is important if the impact parameter changes by an order one fractional amount over the observation time. So this had been considered before, a long time ago. One generalization we made is that for nearby lenses, it could be that the apparent motion on the sky is so large that multiple stars are blipped, as we call it. So you can use Rudin on the number of blipped stars. Secondly, for extended sources such as subhalos, as I said, there could be many stars behind any one source, so you can look for correlations in the velocity field. So in fact, if all of these stars were, let's say all of the observer and all of these stars were actually fixed, so they were in our reference frame, if only the lens is moving up, then you would get this correlated velocity field of the stars. And finally, you can also look for acceleration. So here I've drawn sig subhalos. So there can be correlations in say the accelerations of stars. So if you look at nearby star pairs, so here I've circled them in pink. If the separation between the star pairs is smaller than the angular distance to a subhalo, then you can get correlated acceleration shifts. So this would be like taking a power spectrum of the acceleration field of the stars and seeing small scale correlations. The stars, you mean? Yes, yeah. Yeah. So I'll talk. There's intrinsic noise within the stars because they're not stationary. I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay? So, yeah, I won't go over this in great detail, but to tell you that we're somewhat serious. So what we do is we sum over all stars, for example, for this blip observable. We weight by how noisy we think the star should be, which you know beforehand. And then this is essentially a matched filter. So this is the this is the data, so the positions of the stars, or the, say, position residuals. And you dot them in, you take the dot product with what the predicted lensing deflection is for a given lens path XL. So if you guess the lens path correctly, then this sum would add up for all of the sources and all of the observation times, and you get a non-zero signal. So in some sense, this is an optimal estimator. It's the maximum likelihood estimator. Likewise for template velocity. So you take velocity data, you weight them by how noisy the star is, and you dot them into some velocity template, which depends on the position of the template, the size of the template, and its velocity. And for correlated accelerations, what you do is you take the power spectrum of say, angular acceleration. So you take a star pair, which is a star I and a star j. So you sum over all those pairs, you dot them into each other, you weigh by how noisy the star is, and you do some angular scaling bit. So beta is an angular impact parameter.
Yeah. So
what you do, yeah, good. So what you do is, so these are test statistics, right? So you always test for a consistency with a given lens population or a given lens. So for the blip observable, what you do is you guess a lens path XL, right? And then given a lens path, you can work out what the deflection is of all of the stars, and then you see, is my data consistent with that lensing deflection? So you have to test for a tremendous number of possible lensing deflection, right? So on the order of 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 12 to make sure you don't miss the signal. Yeah. So basically, for the blip, right, the ones that contribute are the stars I within this little box. So basically, what you need to do is you need to sum over the stars for which the impact parameter changes by order one, which is roughly, if the lens moves from here to here, is you look for all of the stars in this box. Here I've drawn two, but it could be hundreds or thousands. Okay, so this is a sensitivity frontier, and so there are precision instruments now that do astrometry. The most important one is Gaia, the one that's running right now. So it's a satellite that's measuring the positions of stars to 10 microarcseconds for about a billion objects, mostly inside the Milky Way, but some outside the Milky Way. And there's future successors to Gaia as well. And then there's also ground-based radio surveys that use radio interferometry to measure the positions of stars. They already have 10 microarcsecond precision on the light centroid of quasars, but not yet a huge catalog of sources, though with SKA this could improve very quickly. Okay, I don't think I have too much time. So this is the uncertainty on how well you measure the position of a star versus how bright it is. So the solid lines are for Gaia. So this is its positional precision. So it's 10 microarcseconds for the brightest stars, and it gets worse for the faintest ones. This is the average angular velocity in blue, angular acceleration in red. And these are future projections for Theia, which is projected to do about a factor of 40 better. And then to get back to your question, you know, the instrumental precision on the velocity is this. But of course, Gaia measures, it is meant to map out the motions of structures in the Milky Way. And so, for example, even a low velocity dispersion object like Omega Centauri has an intrinsic angular velocity noise that's quite large relative to the instrumental one. And the Large Magellanic Clouds are a little bit better, but they're mostly limited by velocity dispersion noise.
So do you assume that this velocity dispersion noise is just white noise? Or
I'll get to that at the end.
But yeah, there are correlated velocities also. Okay, so this is what you can do in terms of sensitivity to compact objects. So these would be like, this would be like a Macho search. So this is as a function of mass, from 10 to the minus 10 solar masses to 10 to the 10. And this is, here would be all of dark matter. Here is 10%, so on a log scale. These are previous constraints from microlensing by Kepler and Eros. These are dynamical constraints. And so with these outliers, we think you can look for heavy lenses, so outlier velocities, outlier accelerations. But really, the main strength is with these blip observables that can constrain populations as small as 10 to the minus 7 of the dark matter. So the mono blips are better for rare populations, but the multi blips give you quite spectacular signatures, potentially. So this is for compact objects. So here I've assumed zero size, and I've also assumed a delta function for the mass distribution. You can convolute this with extended mass distributions.
And you've afforded the probability of lensing, right?
The solid line would be for the full Gaia catalog after 5 years for a billion objects. And so this, the sensitivity mainly comes from observations of the galactic disk in the Magellanic Clouds. So it does here. The dashed line is for Theia. This is also observations of the Magellanic Clouds, and this is for the disk with Gaia. Okay, so for subhalos, so these are finite size objects. So this is the size in parsec. So this is 1 parsec and 1 kiloparsec. The standard prediction, so if you assume that the spectrum of density fluctuations measured in the CMB continues all the way down to small scales, you get some standard prediction where the density is approximately constant for subhalos. So that's the standard NFW line. And with template, so the solid lines are again what we think you can do with Gaia. So the solid lines, so correlated velocities are here in green, correlated accelerations are here, and template velocities of Magellanic Cloud, template velocity observations of the Magellanic Clouds would have this sensitivity. And then future improvements with SKA can get you these blue dashed lines and green dashed lines. And with Theia observations of disk stars, you get the red line.
So you assume 100% dark matter?
I assume 100% dark matter at the core mass of the halo. Good. So this is the standard NFW prediction where things collapse at standard redshifts of 10. But if you have an enhanced spectrum of density fluctuations or some new dissipative dynamics in your dark matter sector, the halos can collapse at higher redshifts. So this is what the size of the halo would be if it collapsed at redshift 30 or at 300. So you see in these non-standard scenarios where the halo collapses after matter radiation equality, but earlier than expected, these are things that we can probe. So here's the same plot, but with the y-axis changed. So this is density and solar mass per cubic parsec. So you see roughly for the standard scale invariant spectrum, the density only varies logarithmically over this huge mass range. So we think you can see with this method and using SKA observations of extragalactic sources, we think you can see subhalos that are heavier than a million solar masses, even in the standard scenarios, and much lighter ones for non-standard small-scale structure spectra. Any questions about this? How much time do I have, by the way?
You have 5 minutes.
Okay.
So the fact that they collapse earlier means that they have a central region. They are denser.
Definitely can't hear you.
Yeah, they are denser. Yes, if they collapse earlier, roughly, if the density goes like the collapse redshift cubed, So if you can interpret this in terms of a primordial power spectrum as a function of co-moving wave number, so we've measured in the CMB temperature and anisotropy spectrum that the power is about 10 to the minus 9 in curvature squared.
And so you get the standard spectrum if you extrapolate this all the way down with a straight line. But if the spectral index is allowed to change, so if there's a running of the spectral index or a running of the running, the yellow band is actually the one sigma best fit, which you should not take seriously because they haven't probed it here. But it's just to show that there could be an enhancement in primordial power, and we think we can do better than spectral distortions of the CMB to these non-standard scenarios. Again, over a relatively large range of co-moving wave numbers. Okay, so I started with a planet and I'll end with a planet. We think you can actually look for new planets in our own solar system. So these are the rocky planets. I hope this works. Yeah, so these are the four gas giants. And recent observations of trans-Neptunian objects, such as Sedna and a bunch of objects beyond the Kuiper Belt, look a little weird. So their perihelia are clustered. So both the argument of the perihelia, as well as the inclination of the orbit and the longitude of the perihelia, suggests that there's a perturbation by a massive object, Planet 9, with a perihelion of 200 AU and an aphelion of 1200 AU, and with a mass of about half that of Neptune, or 10 times that of Earth. And if true, this would show up in Gaia for sure. It's hard to see, so you might say, why have we not detected such a planet? But the power in reflected sunlight goes like 1 over r to the fourth. So you pay Gauss's law twice for the light to get there and to go back, and it roughly goes like the area of the object. So if Neptune was at 1,000 AU, we would not know it was there. But the lensing angle can actually be quite substantial. So the lensing angle is 4 times G Newton times the mass divided by the impact parameter. So if it has an Earth-sized mass and an impact parameter of 1 AU, then the lensing deflection is a few times 10 to the minus 2 microarc seconds. But planets move large arcs on the sky, even ones that are at 1,000 AU or so. So, okay, if the angular number density is 10 to the 8 per steradian, which is the worst case scenario for Gaia, so that's if it's in a random spot on the sky, then the number of stars that it blips, so the number of stars in this box, is about 400. And much larger if it's in front of the galactic disk, which may actually be the case, given the fits to the orbits on the previous slide. So the signal-to-noise ratio actually only scales like 1 over r, so it's much better than this 1 over r to the fourth scaling. So with good sensitivity, so if your effective sensitivity to the positions of stars improves, you can see much farther, and the scaling is much less favorable here. So this is what we think you can do with Gaia in solid. So this is if it's in a random spot on the sky. This is if it's in front of the disk. So this would be mass in Earth masses as a function of present-day distance, which you can think of as orbital radius, say. So these are the four gas giant planets. These are the two heaviest dwarf planets. And roughly, so this is apparent magnitude in reflected sunlight. And roughly speaking, if a planet were magnitude 22 or higher, we would not have seen it. So basically, we can exclude anything below magnitude 20 for sure. For example, Eris was only found in 2005. If it was magnitude 30, those are things that Hubble can see in an extremely long exposure. But because planets move, it would not have shown up in Hubble exposures. And so the blue box. So the best fit is if it's between 5 and 20 Earth masses, and between 200 and 1200 AU. And sort of the lower half of this box is excluded by observations, but it could be near its aphelion. I'm not going to show you the video again. But the farthest distance away from the sun is actually where it points towards the galactic disk, where our sensitivity would be. much better. And that's actually also where it's much harder to see it directly, because if it's in front of a background light, it's harder to detect in infrared and in reflected sunlight. So that's the ideal case for us. Gaia would have to give the full time series data for us to do this analysis, which they plan to do, but not in the upcoming data release yet. So to get back to systematics, maybe this is good discussion material. So I've only told you about stochastic noise, such as individual star noise or instrumental noise, but there's systematics for all of the observables that I've talked about, but we think you can discriminate them or circumvent them. So for outlier velocities, there are hypervelocity stars, but with using nearby, yeah, maybe during the discussion. But to get back to Neil's question, so yeah, there are coherent velocity fields like rotational velocities or velocity streams. But those are typically, say, if you do an observation of the Large Magellanic Cloud, those are on scales of a few degrees because that's the size of the Magellanic Cloud. In my sensitivity plots, the angular size of the lenses that we would be sensitive to are much smaller. So it would be velocity correlations on much smaller scales. So there's this an angular scaling that you can use to reduce the systematic from coherent velocity fields. Or you can look at, ultimately, if your sensitivity is that good, you will be plagued by the systematic, and then you can use extragalactic sources that should not have those correlated velocity fields. Correlated accelerations are not an issue, so there are coherent acceleration fields, but these are so unobservably small that you don't need to do any tricks, actually. Okay, so to conclude, modern astrometric surveys have incredible precision and huge catalogs, so you can do statistics. In particular, you can do time domain astrometric weak gravitational lensing and hopefully measure the motions and the mass spectrum of dark objects in the Milky Way. Thank you.
I understand you were still considering individual dark matter objects for setting limits, right?
Say it again. I'm constraining.
You're considering individual lenses, if I'm not wrong. To set limits on compact objects. Or,
yes.
Is it possible to ask for correlations of these lenses to set limits on, say, today's power spectrum or something like that? Today's dark matter power spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I understand your question. So the velocity, the correlation observables, in some sense, measure the power spectrum at small scales.
Of bions.
No, of dark matter. Okay. Of dark matter.
That's what this last.
That's what the correlation observable does. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, it's a little bit. It's not exactly the mass spectrum because I do some weighting by how noisy the star is, and I do some angular scaling as well. So the map is indirect, but yeah, in principle, this probes the small-scale power spectrum of dark matter. Yeah.
So the first macro lensing experiments in the 90s, as you know, did see a lot of macro lensing of stars in the galactic bulb.
Yes.
Through a quartz window, something like 2 or 3 × 10⁻⁶ object at depth.
Yeah.
As far as I know, these objects were never identified, the objects that were responsible
right.
for the lensing. And they
yes.
were not seen by Hubble in particular. They were like subsolar mass.
Yes.
There was even speculation by some people that this could be mirror matter or something.
Yeah, yeah. So
are you saying now, in your last slide, when you talked about Planet 9,
yeah.
that the next slide you had a sensitivity for Hubble?
Yeah. So magnitude 30.
So
yeah. Sorry. I mean, they would show up. Sorry, I don't know where it's playing. So let me show you the compact object plot. So it's true that I think Eros, or maybe the one before Eros, saw.
Macho,
yeah. Yeah, or Macho saw lensing events here. So they could be brown dwarfs. You don't know how far they are. or arrows, right? Because you look towards the Magellanic Bulge.
Probability is maximum halfway to the.
Exactly, exactly. So most objects you see would be halfway. So what they did was photometric lensing, right? But it's true also for astrometric lensing that the most likely line of sight distance is halfway to your stellar field, right? And here I'm assuming you look towards the galactic bulge or the disk. So likewise, it would be 5 kiloparsec away. And if it's, you know, you can, you, at high enough signal to noise ratio, you can actually measure the mass. And if the mass is again, you know, around here, you know, say a percent of a solar mass, you don't know what it is. I mean, it could be a brown dwarf. That's probably the most conservative explanation. And if it's 5 kiloparsec away, you would not see it. But if the density of objects is large enough that it has a multi-blip, so multi-blip preferentially looks for objects that traverse large arcs on the sky, so it actually has the highest signal-to-noise ratio for the closest lens, so the closest object, and on those you might be able to do an optical follow-up. And a multi-blip, you actually, because you have multiple measurements of the lens, you actually get quite accurate, potentially, it depends on your signal-to-noise ratio, but you get potentially quite accurate positional information. So you can do a deep exposure that even tracks the motion of the lens with say, Hubble or a radio interferometer. Yeah.
So for the, it looked like you were using all of the stars in Gaia. Mm-hmm. But many of these stars are going to have high magnitudes, they're going to be faint, and they might not have as good of angular resolution as
yes.
you need. So once you put in a realistic magnitude cut on...
That's what we did. So what we did is in these observables, so the best angular resolution is this, but the effect... So the effective noise that you care about is basically... So let's say... You want to look at accelerations, right? So the effective, can everyone see this? The effective angular acceleration noise is, if you do this weighting by the expected noise, is the average inverse variance. In inverted again. So this is the effective angular acceleration variance is basically the average of the inverse variances inverted. So that turns out to be, so you see that the best precision of Gaia is like 1.5 microarc seconds for the best ones, but it's terrible for the faint ones. So if you weight each star with, you know, with how noisy you expect it to be, the most of the contribution to your sensitivity, you know, comes from this region. And and if you do this for all of the stars in the Gaia data set, the effective sigma alpha is about 9 microarc seconds. Yeah, but it's true.
And then just one related question to that. So so it seems a bit simplistic to model the background velocity distribution as a single Gaussian, because there's, as you were mentioning in your last slide,
yeah,
there are out of equilibrium effects, but also just there are anisotropic velocity dispersions in the different directions, and the velocities change as a function of metallicity and so forth.
Right,
so
right.
Is this something you're worried about, or you can include into your test statistic more general background velocity dispersion profiles?
Right.
Or
you can include. I mean, we didn't, just for brevity, we didn't do that, but yeah, so. If you, I mean, you can measure photometrically, say, the spectrum of the star, like you say, the metallicity, and then older stars typically have higher velocity dispersions than younger stars, so you can fold that in as well. But we didn't do that, but I don't expect qualitatively different results if you do. So, yeah. Okay, Jeff?
Is there still a mass reach window of primordial black holes which are above the solar masses which have not been ruled out yet?
That's under debate.
Work for that as well?
Yes. That's the wrong way. Our blip observables are ideal for those. So the window I think you're talking about is this one here. This one is under debate, and there's also if these compact objects are primordial black holes, there's also a stringent CMB bound that looks like a wall that roughly here. And so both this constraint and the CMB bound has been under debate recently, especially after LIGO. But Gaia should be able to see such a population at a very high signal-to-noise ratio. So here, the signal-to-noise ratio would be 10 to the 4 or so.
So you can rule out the existing window.
Or see it, yeah. Yes, you're sensitive to it, yeah.
In general, when you do these things, you have to assume some distribution of the dark matter in the Milky Way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly are you assuming? That it's Poisson distributed throughout, or just random distribution? Or are you making some sort of clustering approximation or that you're doing as well?
Yeah. Here, it's quite simplistic modeling. So here I'm assuming a uniform distribution of lenses and, a Gaussian velocity dispersion of the lenses as well. There are correlations, of course. So there's a power spectrum of clustering. And for example, for subhalos, there's sub-subhalos within subhalos, right? And those have higher density as well. So we didn't model for that, but I think the clustering you're talking about would only help us.
Yeah, I agree. It'll make the objects look heavier. I don't know if that helps you or doesn't help you, but in general, it's going to be very significant, right? If you form primordial black holes, ad maturation, radiation equality, or before that, let's say, then you'd have significant clustering until today.
Yeah,
so I'm not sure if that helps you or doesn't help you. It'll push your mass spectrum to a higher mass spectrum.
I think for the blip observable, you're dominated by the heaviest one. So if you're talking about primordial black holes, then this is lensing from a single point mass. If there's multiple ones, it might confound the observation. I mean, you might modify the test statistic, but ours would no longer work as well. For NFW subhalos, in particular this one, so here we've assumed a uniform density distribution of lenses of subhalos and a Gaussian velocity distribution. But if within a big subhalo, you're more likely to find many smaller halos that are increasingly dense, that actually would boost our signal-to-noise ratio. So we did not take that into account because it's not been modeled yet. So simulations don't have resolutions to resolve this. But if that's the case, actually, we can significantly underestimate the sensitivity.
So the last question.
Yeah.
So if you can go back to your plot of constraints on the previous slide.
This one?
Yeah. So for primordial black holes, there's also quite a strong constraint from Subaru HSC between Kepler and Eros, and you do not have it. So I'm wondering if there's
from what?
Subaru hyper subprime between Eros and Kepler goes to 10 to minus 3.
Ah, sorry. Maybe then I've missed a new constraint. Sorry. Please tell me after that.
I have a question. Besides the, and this would be the last one I have, as we have to start with high wall. For the mini halos, besides the substructure, it seems to be that the distribution would be important for this. Have you assumed an NFW profile? If the profile is different, this would change if they are more diffuse or something?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the blip observables are very sensitive to the inner density profile. Sorry, I don't remember.
Yeah, the inner density.
Yeah, so we assumed an NFW profile. So we assumed gamma is 1 here, meaning that at large distances, so distances larger than the size of the object, it falls off as 1 over r cubed. And near the core, it goes like 1 over r, the density. For our subhalo test statistics are insensitive to the precise value of gamma if it's less than 2. So for this is what we call a soft lens. So unless it's very steep in the inner core, which NFW halos should not be, my sensitivity curves will not change dramatically. If gamma is larger than 2, then it will, and then it looks more like a point mass. Then you're dominated not by sort of the statistics, but the closest approach. Yeah.
Okay, let us thank the speaker, our first speaker, and let us welcome Haibo Yu speaking about So interacting, self-interacting dark matter and velocity distribution.